now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark and joining me today is Gregor Robertson, Johnny Northcroft, and for the first time this season, our new signing, who will be joining us every Thursday, it's Martin Samuel. Welcome to the game, Martin.
Thank you very much, Tom.
You're delighted to be here, I'm
delighted to be here. I started the game with a lot of other Times colleagues in 2007. It was the reason they got me to be their chief football writer.
And now you're back on the podcast.
16 years later, it's still going.
Lovely
stuff.
So there
we go. He must have done something right.
Now, we'll be getting to know Martin a little bit later on, including the time he nearly blew up the entire press pack on a trip to South America.
Yeah,
save that for later. We'll also be asking him about his scariest managerial meetings. But we've got lots of football to talk as well. We'll be talking West Ham. We'll be talking Wolves. We'll be talking about that title decider at the weekend at the Etihad. Already, we've got a title decider. Mm-hmm. That's right. After one game this season, but we're going to start with Manchester United. They kicked off their season with a 1-0 win against Wolves at Old Trafford. But Martin, you, like many others, I think, weren't particularly impressed.
No.
Your column in the Times on Tuesday was headlined, "Manchester United are still a work in progress and Erik ten Hag is to blame." So tell us more.
Yeah, well, the second part of that I thought was a little bit of an extrapolation, but...
blaming the sub-editors already.
Yeah, exactly, we'll start. I was just looking at it and I thought they were two players short. And the two players I thought they were short were Declan Rice and Harry Kane. Mm. And if they'd have got those two players and at various times in the last decade, we all thought that they were going to get one of those two players. I thought if Manchester United had Kane in their forward line, if they had Declan Rice alongside Casemiro, you'd look at them and think, well, they're getting there. This is a title. This is a team that might contend a title. Certainly, with what we know about Manchester City now, that they've got the next 4 months without Kevin De Bruyne. And instead, you're looking at them, and let's be honest, Wolves are much the better team, and they shouldn't be much the better team. I know it's one game, and things improve, and things change, but you looked at Manchester United and thought, well, they've still got a way to go here. And, you know, the centre forward that they've bought, the striker that they bought, is 20 years old. He's played one season in the top European league, but it's in any European league, really. I mean, it's 32 games for Atalanta, scored 9 goals. You know, that is not a guy that will necessarily take the pressure off Marcus Rashford. Whereas, we all know Harry Kane would have done.
Yeah.
And we all know he had a price now.
Yeah.
And it might have been a little bit more to Manchester United. And we all know Declan Rice had a price. Everyone at West Ham has got a price. So... They were there. They were there to be got.
Mm. Could they have bought both of them though this summer?
Could they have got both of them? Yeah.
Staying within financial rules?
Yeah. Well, if Chelsea can amortise and do what they're doing, I don't see why Manchester United can't do the same.
Yeah. Well, they've had trouble shifting players, haven't they? I mean,
yeah.
Johnny, you're nodding along with everything Martin's saying. Do you agree?
I do. The big one for me is Declan Rice, actually. I mean, it's not as if they haven't tried to explore Harry Kane. As you wrote, Martin, it's been a sort of 10-year project almost, that one. I can forgive United, or I can understand United deciding that would be too big a saga, Daniel Levy, all that kind of stuff. We don't know if Daniel Levy would have sold him to another English club, but I think you're bang on about Declan Rice, because the big hole in that United team for years has been central midfield. They got Casemiro almost by accident at the end of last year. I say by accident, but you know, didn't set out that summer to get him, and it worked, but There's a worry, an actual worry about Casemiro's age, the signs that he might be starting to get to a point where he's maybe not going to be brilliant every week, and he's certainly not going to cover the big midfield spaces by himself.
On his own, yeah.
But even if there's no worry about Casemiro, United surely to be a top team have to get into the habit of buying from that position of strength and not from position of necessity, which is what they've been doing for years. And Declan Rice was on the market, leadership, room to improve, someone to drive a team forward. I'd have thought every team,
potential.
Every team should have been, every big team should have been out for him. Every single big, maybe so, without City, with Rodri, of course.
Very true. But so both of you, in our preview show with Alisson and Tom Roddy, Greg and I were talking about their signings and talking about Mason Mount, and he was a one of big debate between the group of us, good signing or not good signing. Of the signings they've made then, are you underwhelmed? Is it a case that it's actually left them lagging behind? You know, Onana, you could say, solved the goalkeeper issue for him a little bit?
I like Onana because I think United have been behind the other big teams because they've had an old-fashioned goalkeeper for too long. So they've joined the party. I think they needed to do that years ago, and he's a good option. Mount's a funny one. Not that he's not a good player, but I thought that Declan Rice would have fitted the need a lot better than another attacking midfielder.
Yeah, I like Mount, but he's coming off an absolute bummer of a season with Chelsea, as are a lot of other Chelsea players, to be fair, and they have started more brightly. But he is coming off of a very draining season with Chelsea, where things didn't go right, where there was a backlash against him being included in Gareth Southgate's England teams when he came on. It never seemed a popular decision. Everyone had, you know, he seems to have lost ground from where he was a few years ago. And I can totally understand why Manchester United went for him. I can understand that because he's a good player. And if you're Erik ten Hag, you'd be looking at him thinking, if we can get a tune out of this guy, it moves us forward. But watching them the other night and knowing that the current England captain and quite possibly the future England captain have both moved this summer, and they are both players that have been... Declan Rice is... family certainly won the phone to West Ham all the way through last summer, asking, you know, have you heard from Manchester United yet? Have you heard from Manchester United yet? So, you know, they clearly thought there was something happening there.
Yeah.
And the Harry Kane thing, I mean, what I cited in the column was a conversation with Ed Woodward on a plane where we found ourselves sitting next to each other, and I cannot tell you how delighted he was with that. But we had a conversation, and he was very candid about it. And what he said in that conversation was, you know, that he didn't see getting Harry Kane as beyond the realms of possibility. And his argument was that Daniel Levy likes a deal, will always do a deal. You know, with some clubs, you phone up and you say, well, how much do you want for so-and-so? And you can't get an answer. You'll get an answer out of Daniel.
Yeah, so do you think, you're talking about a slight missed opportunity here then, do you think it's a lack of ambition from United at the moment in relation to how they've kind of looked at themselves, looked at the league? You know, you're talking about these deals, you're saying Declan Rice, his camp would have been interested, you're talking about Harry Kane, it's a big opportunity. Is it a missed opportunity, or is it lack of ambition?
If I could maybe give the Ten Hag view, which I do kind of understand.
Yep.
I think that guy's coming.
He looks similar, so I mean, you know, that's
he's got a great look, hasn't he? You know? Good beard. Nice hair. He came in with so many problems to solve, so many holes to fill, and so many ways in which he needed to adapt what Manchester United were to the kind of football he plays. So I understand he's looking at this thing and thinking, well, I need this, I need this, I need this, and I need this. And he's come at a time where, to touch Gregor's point, United are trying to budget, and they were telling people at the start of the summer that signings would have to come within a sort of £100 million budget. So I think I can understand Ten Hag thinking he needs a goalkeeper, striker, and I said Mount is a slightly odd one. I think the reason, and they weren't the only club that wanted Mount, it was all more availability and opportunity, and just thinking, young English, brilliant pressing, everyone wants pressing, let's go for him. But Ten Hag needs to make the decisions in terms of priorities. And that's where Declan Rice comes in. Because I would have thought the priority absolutely is sorting out that engine room. And I think of the cup final where Man City just playing football at a different pace to United, and the United's midfield were just so slow and couldn't cope either end of the pitch, really. Couldn't get up, couldn't get back.
Yeah, you talk about engine room and you talk about that pace. That to me was one of the most interesting things about watching Monday. You know, you try to learn so much and read so much into one game. But Gregor, I found myself watching Monday thinking, this kind of could be Man United from any stage of any of the last four seasons. You know, this didn't look like a Man United that had a full year of Erik ten Hag, had had a full pre-season, and were suddenly new and vibrant and brilliant. What did you think in terms of on the pitch and their performance?
Yeah, I mean, more worryingly almost, is that that's kind of seemed more to do with systemic issues. The way that Man United was getting carved open through the midfield. Mateus Cunha's searing runs through the centre of the pitch. But then if you look at the first weekend on a whole, you could say the same. There were issues with Chelsea and Liverpool about how to kind of close up the midfield.
Yeah.
Because everyone now plays with a front five.
Yeah.
In possession.
But I'd say those two clubs, just very quickly to go back at you on that, have gone through a bit more flux than Manchester United have. The theory is that they've had the full year of Ten Hag and then they've had a settled summer. Should they not be more further progressed than that?
Maybe, but I think we're trying to see the we're seeing the progression that he's trying to enact at Manchester United, and part of that is building from the back more, and because they've got a new goalkeeper who can do it.
Yeah.
And because a lot of teams now, I've mentioned it on Monday, are playing with inverted fullbacks to try and kind of assist the holding midfielder in closing up shop when they're playing with they're higher up the pitch. I'm not sure Man United have got that really option. They tried to do it a little bit with Luke Shaw, but that's the thing. I think it's like it's almost more worrying that their systemic issues were kind of glaringly flawed in this opening game than the fact that they've missed out on players who you think a club of Manchester United stature, should be in the running to try and sign.
Mm. I love the inverted fullbacks thing. Because everyone sort of, everyone goes, this one plays with inverted fullbacks and that one plays where you go. Yeah. So basically, this one copies Pep Guardiola.
Yeah.
And that one copies Pep Guardiola because no one played with inverted fullbacks and then Pep played with inverted fullbacks and now everybody plays with inverted fullbacks.
You know, West Ham aren't going to do it under Moisey,
don't worry. No, they're not. We're going to play with introverted fullbacks. They're scared of their own shadow.
We'll come on to West Ham and to Pep Guardiola later on, but just to finish on Manchester United, one of the big issues hanging over that club this summer is the future of Mason Greenwood, of course. Mm. Obviously, an incredibly sensitive situation to discuss. Martin, you've got some views, though, on the responsibility that the club has in the case of Mason Greenwood.
I've always said this, that everyone talks about the responsibility the club has to make sure that whatever they perceive to be justice in these circumstances is done. But where they have got a responsibility is to a player, as he is now, that was a seven-year-old schoolboy at Manchester United. So they can't just chuck this to someone else. They can't just chuck this to Juventus and go, right, it's up to you now to make this person, to rehabilitate this person in society. This is your problem. Mm. Because they have more. If the old Jesuit thing about give me the boy and I'll show you the man or whatever. I'm probably doing the Jesuit religion no favours there whatsoever. But they've had the 7 year old boy, so they have got a duty to try to make him a member of society that behaves in the correct way. That is Manchester United's, I think, and I've always thought, that is Manchester United's responsibility. Looking at their statement yesterday, it seems that they might agree with that, and that he could be coming back, but that he will come back in this very controlled way, shall we say, and that they will try to steer this in a way that is responsible. And I respect all of the other issues around it. I respect people, but there's a lot of people that talk about how much they believe in, rehabilitation and redemption or whatever, but are then very keen on banning someone for life and stopping them ever playing football again. And you go, well, that's not actually the same as rehabilitation and redemption and all of this. there's an audio. We all know what we heard on the audio. We all know what we thought of the audio when we heard it. And if that is Mason Greenwood on the audio, we will all have an opinion of that. And it won't be a, high opinion. Mm. However, there is a duty on the part of Manchester United to see this through, if they can see this through, to a place where they take responsibility for the man.
Johnny, do you agree?
It's an interesting take, and it does kind of meld with something I've been thinking about it, and it is this idea of rehabilitation, responsibility, transparency, I suppose, which is where we are. So, you know, should Mason Greenwood come back, there's a kind of narrow way of looking at it, and there's a holistic way of looking at it, a global way of looking at it. The narrow one is, you know, by employment law, by law of the land, blah, 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 should he come back? And I think United are steering to the point where that the answer to that is yes. But, of course, the broader view is should he come back in terms of, is he somebody that they as an institution want to see on the pitch representing them? Is he someone that their supporters and their players are comfortable with? And by the way, I find it insulting the idea that it's the women's team that should be asked.
Oh, the women's team thing is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I find it insulting to women and I find it insulting to men because it says only women can have an opinion about domestic violence. But I guess what I'm getting to is, of course he can come back, but who's comfortable with that? Who wants to see that? And if United have had this exhaustive investigation and think the answer to that is yes, I think they need to tell us what that investigation, without breaking the stuff around the anonymity of the victim, I think they need to lay that out. And I think Richard Arnold, the chief exec, needs to do a lot more than the intended video statement. I think he needs a press conference.
Yeah.
And ideally, I think we need to speak to Martin's point, I think they need to help Mason Greenwood back into the public domain if that's what they think is right. And they need to get him to speak about this, because for me to enjoy watching Mason Greenwood again and to have any confidence that this is the right thing, I need an explanation. I need to hear from him. And as difficult as that is for a kid who's not a great communicator anyway, never liked the media to start with, but they have to help him do that. They have to help their supporters. And until that point, I'm not going to feel comfortable with it. And I understand anyone who feels uncomfortable with it too. But I also understand there's another opinion. Yeah. It's just it reminds me a little bit of the clubs that have been, and I'm going to be careful here not to conflate Mason Greenwood with David Goodwillie in terms of what they've done or alleged to have done.
Yeah.
But the clubs that have tried to sign David Goodwillie since he was named as a rapist in a civil case in Scotland have all taken the same approach. They've signed him, and then it's been can we get away with it? And then they back down when there's been a backlash. What they haven't done is communicated first, asked people first, had an open process, and then discussed it. It's been, and United look like they're going down the route of, can we get away with this? And that's not the right thing.
Yeah, that's the thing, Manchester United, you do fear like they've not handled it well already and we're not at the conclusion yet.
Yeah.
But Martin's point fundamentally is that he's going to return to playing football again. He will, because he's too talented and someone will see an opportunity and take it. And for that reason, you do kind of lean towards it being the club that he has been with since he was 7 years old and know him and like, as he says, has a sort of bit of a responsibility to guide them back to being an upstanding member of society.
And when I'm talking about rehabilitation, I'm talking about exactly the sort of thing there that Johnny is saying about actually, you know, going public about certain things and you know, representing the club and allowing Mason Greenwood to represent himself and not just a load of excuses and, you know, subterfuge and, you know, sneaking back. You know, to actually be out in front of all this. Because we can all understand, I think, that it's a problem for Manchester United, and it's not a problem that, you know, you know, you've got marketing guys as chief executives and stuff. Like, you know, they're not necessarily used to, you know, no one at Manchester United, you know, Erik ten Hag or whatever, there's not a manager's playbook for what happens if a piece of audio is released that is absolutely abhorrent to anybody, and the suggestion is, this is one of your players in this audio. You know, there's no playbook for that. No. So I can appreciate that it's a really difficult issue for them, but if the fact that we trust seven-year-olds, eight-year-olds with football clubs is to mean anything, then they have got to be able to take responsibility in a situation like this and say, this was our employee, this was our teenager, this was our schoolboy, right, we will sort this out.
Yeah, certainly incredibly complex issue, and you get the impression we'll hear more from Manchester United. That statement seemed like a kind of preemptive tease to hearing more from them.
Maybe they were trying to test the ground.
Potentially, that is also potentially the case. Henry Winter has written about this situation on the Times website. You can read about that now. As I said at the top, just one of many issues that it feels like is hanging over Manchester United at the minute. I'm going to do the classic thing that all presenters get to do now and go, well, we've got to talk about Wolves. Because they played Manchester United in that game, and as you said, mine, they played them off the park.
Off the park,
didn't they?
Really,
I mean, we had this team that going into this season, we thought they were going to be the chaos club. I was speaking to Charlotte Dunker, our Midlands correspondent, getting her to write a piece the other week saying, we've got to tee this up, they're going to be a car crash. And then they waltz onto the pitch at Old Trafford, one of the best teams of the opening weekend.
Well, everyone's fighting out their lives. I was talking about this earlier. I would have thought most chairmen, most owners, most managers, fans or whatever, looking at it thinking, right, well, Sheffield United look as if they're going to be in trouble.
Yeah.
Luton Town, it's going to be very, very hard for Luton Town to stay up with their budget, the size of the club. So that leaves one existing Premier League team. And everyone was sitting there feeling very smug, thinking, well, it's going to be Wolves and we can nick into 17th and we'll be all right. And then suddenly you see Wolves and you go, we're in trouble because they don't look like a bottom three team.
No, absolutely. Johnny, you, Gary O'Neill, you interviewed him last season. Yeah. A smart choice as manager?
Unbelievably good choice, and maybe a slightly fortuitous choice when you think of it's come around with Lopetegui leaving. But they stumbled on one of the managers of the year who kept an infinitely less talented squad at Bournemouth up and has immediately got a pattern, a character, a purpose to the Wolves side. You can see his imprint straight away. He's a very driven but also very kind of approachable, decent sort of guy. I think he'll go a long way. Yeah. And Wolves are incredibly lucky to have him. And Cunha, I mean,
Chelsea will be Cunha's signing him next, won't they? Pretty soon.
Well, only if Man United come in for him first.
Although there was no goal. He scored two goals last season. I think that no one else in that
Here comes Mr. Realist every time.
No, they were great to watch, but you do look at the team and think, where's the goals? It was the same last season.
Yeah.
I was reading in the last three seasons, they failed to score in 45 Premier League games, which is more than any other team. He scored two last season. No one in the starting lineup scored more than two goals last season for any other team. Fabio Silva came back. He'd been on loan last season, I think, at Anderlecht. They look good, but they still need the end product, and that's my worry for them.
Everton are the same, aren't they? I mean, it could be like a record low-scoring team to stay up. But it's funny how many teams are just... It's just the disappearance of number nines, isn't it? Yes. So many teams are struggling in that department.
Well, perfectly links me to the next topic, which is another team who are desperately in need of a goal scorer, and that's West Ham. Martin, this is the first part of the meet Martin Samuel. I'm going to out you as a West Ham fan for Game Podcast listeners, which pits you perfectly against the senior chairman of the David Moyes fan club in Johnny Northrop. So, boys, have at it. Moyes is shocking. You want Moyes out. Moyes is a legend.
I don't want Moyes out.
I've just got to say, I don't mind the chairman of the David Moyes fan club. But you see,
listen, I'm the secretary as well. Let's not forget that. I love Moyes as well. Don't worry.
No, but you seem to be suggesting there's a divide between David Moyes and the club, and that's outrageous.
Well, not a divide between David Moyes and the club, but how do the fans feel, Martin?
No, the way I would say the divide is I mean, you were just citing Gregor's realism as a negative. I think as a West Ham fan, what you wanted was for the coach when the Lucas Paquetá Manchester City thing was mentioned last week. Mm. You didn't want a manager that was saying, well, it's very hard to keep a bloke if Man City comes. You wanted someone. It's true. I don't care whether it's true or not. Fans don't want truth.
I know.
We all know football fans. They don't want truth. They want something that fits their worldview, which is a manager who turns around and says, if Pep Guardiola tries to take Lucas Paquetá, I'll punch him right in the hooter. You know, that's what you want from your manager. And I think it's quite deflated. They're very lucky, West Ham, that this weekend they're playing Chelsea. Because if you can't get 60,000 people in the London Stadium fired up and going like nutcases, to beat Chelsea, then you'll never do it. But if that was a Burnley and it was 2-0 down suddenly and Paquetá's being sold and Jesse Lingard is training with the club, you know, and stuff like that, it would be that atmosphere that we can remember at West Ham from a couple of years ago. Because the difference between West Ham and Brighton, who have both sold a midfielder, I mean, Brighton sold McAllister and Moses Caicedo, and they're not rioting at Brighton. But West Ham fans were sold this vision that there will be a 60,000 stadium and they will be Champions League contenders. Now, you can say it was oversold and you can say that was not realistic, but that's what everyone was buying into. And then they win a European trophy. Mm. It might not be the greatest European trophy, but it was a European trophy and everyone could see how big it was at West Ham. And then they sell their captain to Arsenal. So, okay, well, that's not the greatest, but that's not really what's going to happen if you're going to try and get into the Champions League. But we've still got Lucas Paquetá. They've still got Lucas Paquetá, and he's Brazil's number eight, and he had a in-and-out season in his first season, but you can see there's a player there. Yeah, we've got him. If we can get someone around him, and then that looks like he's going to Manchester City. And that's why there is such a sort of edge about West Ham at the moment, because it is the old cliche, not as advertised.
Johnny, you know Moyes. Sorry, Gregor. Johnny, you know Moyes really well. How do you think he deals with that edge that Martin talks about? Because on the face of it, you know, Martin cites some of those times when they got relegated. He saved them from relegation and then brought them that trophy. And a lot of the things Martin's talking about are out of his control in some respects. How does he handle that edge of being in charge of a club like West Ham, do you think?
Well, he doesn't. I mean, he doesn't want to sell Lucas Paquetá, and I understand what Martin's saying, that you'd love him to come out and get all angry about it. But given we've had a summer that there's been, let's say, tensions between certain parts of the club and other parts in terms of who should come in and out, I think there's a sense of battle weariness there, and this isn't what he may have felt was advertised when he won the Europa Conference League. He may have felt this was a chance to build, and instead it's been a typical West Ham summer in recruitment. I don't know if you agree, and everything's been a bit kind of piecemeal. Hasn't been a sort of clear, assertive transfer strategy. Every signing kind of almost has to be done case by case and begged for and so on. I don't know, he wins matches. I mean, that's the only thing he can really do. It's the only thing he does do. He is in a different position to, let's say, Roberto De Zerbi when Caicedo is going from Brighton, and he doesn't have to justify it. He doesn't have to be a spokesman, because I think Brighton fans understand that's the model. But there is this distance between we're West Ham, we've got the stadium, we're going to be this, and then how the club acts. But you would expect me to say this. I don't see that as a David Moyes issue. I see that as coming from higher up. Maybe it'd be nice if someone else in the club addressed these things.
I was at the press conference last Friday when he, you know, last season it was like Groundhog Day. I covered the European tour, and it was tough, this balance in the Thursdays. Yeah. I was like, God, you know, the same thing, same answers every week. Yeah. This time we turned up, there was Declan Rice, Paquetá, the friction with Tim Stuyten, the new technical director. Yeah. Mm. There was like so much to speak about, and he was positive. He was saying, look, the one thing I have to say is West Ham cannot be accused of not trying to do things in the transfer market this summer. He said, we have tried, but the market has been crazy. Sometimes, you know, the prices we're just not willing to go to. You know, there was also the accusation that West Ham should have tried to get a replacement for Rice before they sold him, because everyone knew he was going.
This is it.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
He said, look, we have. So you could tell, you know, his answer about Tim Steiden was diplomatically put. You could tell he was saying, you know, he's come in from the Bundesliga, he had his targets. There was one question, it was like, you know, why do you think Alvarez, who came from Ajax, why do you think he's going to be okay? Well, we tried to go for Premier League players who knew the Premier League, but we couldn't get him. So there is something there. And the problem is, West Ham, they aren't committed. They aren't committed, fully committed to David Moyes. They aren't fully committed to changing, to getting Tim Steiden and getting a manager who maybe they have the same sort of strategy and viewpoint. They don't feel like a club that's committed to anything.
Yeah.
And that includes the manager.
Yeah. Martin, final word for you. Where do you see the season going? Obviously, last season, Gregor alluded to it there. There was that culture clash between a European chase for a trophy and battling relegation, ultimately. Mm-hmm. Where do you see the season going for West Ham?
I don't see it as being very different. I don't see West Ham as a top half team. So I just don't think it's joined up enough. At West Ham, you know, you can't believe every single transfer rumour you hear or whatever, but, you know, the new director of football is looking at this one at Bayer Leverkusen and that one at Bayer Leverkusen and this one, and you're thinking, it comes from Bayer Leverkusen. I mean, there are other clubs are available, you know. You know, it's that sort of thing. You hear, oh, they were in for Harvey Barnes, but then somebody came in and said they didn't fancy Harvey Barnes, and you're thinking, well, who was that? Because I'd take away his training ground privileges, basically. Yeah. You know, just give us the card, mate. You're not coming near the club again if you don't think Harvey Barnes is a player. Yeah. You know, so it's that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's that you need a philosophy. Chelsea, as mad as it seems, have actually got a philosophy. Mm. It might look like a philosophy that should be accompanied by da 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 da, but it is a philosophy. All of this stuff about giving people these very long-term contracts that start off on low wages, and there is a plan there. I'm not saying it works, but they've got Mauricio Pochettino in, and if anyone can make it work, I think he can. And it is a philosophy. And with West Ham, a lot of the time, it's just too much push-pull all the time. And David Moyes is in the middle of it. And so, you know, it's facetious of me to say that he should be talking more bullishly, because the man's a realist, and I can appreciate that as well. But from a fan's perspective, I do know West Ham fans, and, you know, they would just like sometimes someone to be turning around and saying, well, this guy hasn't got a price. That's what I thought from the very start. When he started talking about, well, City haven't met their valuation for Paquetar. You wanted someone from West Ham to say there is no valuation for Paquetar. Yeah, yeah. We've already sold Declan Rice. We're not selling Paquetar. Yeah.
Johnny, final word for you then on Moyes. How do you see his season going? Are they intertwined? Will he still be there at the end of the season? The big question.
No, I think he will, and I think Gregor will go along to a lot more press conferences that remind him of last year.
Now, talking about West Ham allows us to briefly mention a great fun story of the last 24 hours. 36-year-old former West Ham legend, should we say, Martin?
Mate, he was to me. I don't think I've seen many better players down there in that one season, great season.
Yeah. Dimitri Payet, that may be explains the hero's welcome.
What a player.
Unbelievable,
that season. The hero's welcome that he's got in Brazil as he's joined Vasco da Gama. That gives us the perfect excuse, Martin, for the second part of our Meet Martin during this show. You get to tell us about a certain story of when you arrived with the press pack in Brazil.
Yeah, so what's happened with Dimitri Payet? Signed for Vasco da Gama, who are a club on the edge of the biggest favela in Rio. And he's 36. And there were 5,000 Vasco da Gama fans at the airport. They had to close the airport for this 36-year-old guy to turn up. They're letting off fireworks inside the airport. And it just reminded me, in 2000, we were there at the Club World Cup. We went to this Vasco da Gama friendly because they just signed Edmundo, the Brazilian international Edmundo, pronounced Edmundo, as we discovered that night. And they were playing Algeria in a friendly, and we were sitting there. We just bought tickets. There was about six or seven of us, and we went.
All journalists.
All journalists. This is all journalists. And so we're just sitting there. We're not in the press box. We're just sitting there watching the game. And behind the goal, it was going crackers behind the goal, like flares, banners, everything, because they're so excited about Edmundo. And I said, you know, with the keen understanding of a situation that I have developed over many years watching football, that looks fun. why don't we go over there and watch it with that lot? That looks good. Anyway, so we sort of trooped around the ground and got into the Vasco da Gama Ultras end. Mm. Six of the whitest looking, European looking. It's people like Lee Clayton and Martin Lipton, I think, might have been there. And, you know, so we're all standing there, like soaking up the atmosphere, thinking we'd make friends, you know, in that stupid way that,
they'll love us.
Yeah. What they're seeing is A, possibly Manchester United fans come to a fight. Or B, people with watches on that are about six years money in Brazil, or 6 months money in Brazil, should I say. So we're over there and have worked out quite quickly that it's a hostile environment and it's not the fan experience that we were hoping for. And so we started moving away. And when we moved away, they moved with us, like this little group of about, you know, 50 or 60 ultras. And I still can't remember this part of it, how it actually happened, but we managed to communicate with the police that were in there that we were in serious trouble. And they managed to communicate with us that they will get us out, but they can only get us. I think there might have been one guy that spoke English, that they can get us to the perimeter of the stadium, but they can't go out into the street with us. So we are now going to be turned out into basically a favela. And, you know, being sort of followed by these people. So anyway, so we moved with these police about 5 minutes to go.
Out the ground.
Towards the exit. Yeah. And about 50 to 100 people followed us. And the police are going, we can't go any further than this. And you're just thinking, we're all going to die. This is what's going to happen. We are all going to die. And basically, I've killed everyone. And it was a minivan from the hotel that I was staying in, which was in Ipanema. And they'd taken us to the ground and we'd arranged to meet this guy on the final whistle. And I don't know how this happened. It could be, you know, it could be a divine intervention or something like that. I don't know why any of us deserved that. But because we'd come in round the other side of the stadium. There was no reason why, as the doors opened, we can see our minivan with
glistening
whatever hotel is there as these people have followed us. And we absolutely sprinted for this fan on the other side. And they came with us. And it was like literally just last train out of Dodge or whatever. And we were jumping on these people following us down the road. And we sped off down the street and into the night. And I didn't get the... entire British press corps killed, and some people listen to this may think that was a bad thing. But
are you sure they weren't Sunday supplement viewers?
Yeah, they all wanted autographs.
Well, they'd still been chasing you for the while.
I'm sure Dimitri Payet will enjoy a slightly friendlier reception, it seems, than the rest of the British press corps. Now, if you're listening to the podcast and thinking, hang on a minute, England's women are in a World Cup final, why the hell haven't they talked about it? Don't worry, we've got a special show coming for you. I'm going to be speaking to Owen Slott and Molly Hudson in a special Women's World Cup final preview show, so keep your ears to the ground for that. Gentlemen, we've got plenty still to talk about. We're going to be talking about Manchester City and Newcastle, and we'll be asking Martin and Johnny about the scariest manager they've ever met. Stick with us.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and I'm joined today by Martin Samuel, Johnny Northcroft and Gregor Robertson. There's loads for us still to talk about in part two. Johnny, I wanted to ask you about a piece in the Sunday Times from last weekend. You met and interviewed Akil Howson, who ended the Premier League's 15-year wait for a black official when he ran the line at Sheffield United against Crystal Palace. Just tell us a little bit about the 32-year-old. What was he like and his ambitions within the game?
Yeah, he was very young, actually.
Yes.
I mean, very young, 32. No, I mean, fit as a fiddle and bright and sparky. And it was a privilege to do the interview. I have actually met Akil before, and I don't know if people realise how difficult it is for referees on the way up. But until they get to that PJMOL level and they're professionals, you know, they have to make a living and they have to fit refereeing around sort of normal jobs. And Akil's been he's been a policeman in Leicester and he's worked in security. So I met him when he was working as a bouncer at the Leicester Riders game. So we did have a sort of prior bit of history. And he has been, you know, like a lot of officials, somebody that wanted to become a footballer, wasn't quite good enough. Went into refereeing at the age of 14 when his mother, and I met his mother, Patsy Andrews, who's a local legend. She's another trailblazing referee, actually, one of the very few black female officials that have got to any kind of level in this country. She got to level 6 and refereed sort of, you know, Leicestershire amateur football at a reasonable level. And Akil told me that one day he was getting frustrated with his team that he was on the bench, and he got in the car and Mum was going to take him to training, and she started driving in a different direction. He's like, "Where are we going?" And she said, "Oh, you'll find out when we get there." Parked up outside a clubhouse in Corn, and she said, "Right, there's a refereeing course going on in there. On you go, son." And he sort of kicked off a little bit, and then he said, "Well, it was my mum's." So I went in, and that was the start of a journey for him. But what was really sort of valuable about meeting him, I think, and unpacking it all, is it has been 15 years since we've had a black official of, you know, whether assistant referee or referee in the Premier League, which is quite extraordinary. If we talk about representation, I think it's an even greater scandal than the lack of representation in boardrooms or in the dugout. I mean, 15 years without a single one, black, Asian or mixed heritage, it's just extraordinary. There's never been a black referee in the Champions League ever, which I find incredible when you think about what football pretends is its mission in terms of inclusivity. But anyway, what was great about talking to Akil on this subject was he told me the whole journey. And when people talk about unconscious bias, it can be quite a difficult subject to get across, because some people don't understand it. I think some people want to think it doesn't exist. And what Akil was able to do was give examples and tell you how it does work. And his biggest problem, I think, was coming through as a referee at level 4, level 3, which anecdotally is a sort of barrier point for a lot of referees, where you're trying to transition from the start of men's football to higher up the ladder to maybe non-league. And he said he'd get, like, referee assessors would come and see him, and he's always been extremely fit, but he'd get average marks for fitness. Really? And they said to him things like, "Yeah, but, you know, when you're running, it just looks very easy. So, you know, you're not working hard enough." And he's like, asking, "What does that even mean? Yeah. What's being brought into play there? And why am I getting penalised for running easily?" And he said that an ex-Premier League official actually told him, "Look, what you need to do is roll your head a bit and pump your arms out to make it look like you're working hard," right, or something. Other things about, like, your body language, is you're too relaxed. All these kind of prejudices, I suppose, or bits of baggage that were being brought into the journey. These little things along the way. And he told me about a shocking incident when he was doing role play with his refereeing coach in front of a whole load of other referees. And the role play was supposed to be you've got to pretend that there's an angry manager burst into your room and he wants to complain about the game, and I'll take the role of the manager. And this guy, the coach, ended up screaming at him in this role play, "You're only getting promoted because you're black." And Akhil said it was like, he was absolutely stunned. The room went silent. And it felt like in the moment that this guy actually just wanted to get those words out there, and this was an excuse to do so. So you talk about someone about all of those experiences, and you also think how difficult it is to become any kind of top person in football, referees in particular. And he said when he got the news that he was being promoted, and by the way, he was in the Championship for 10 years doing very well as an assistant, so he's had to wait even at that level a long time. But he said he cried, you know, and he said, to be honest, I still get a bit tearful when I think of it, and it helped me understand why.
It's an amazing story. You can read it on the Times website now. Just on the subject of pathways and referees, Gregor, is it talked about amongst ex-pros? You know, you played at various different levels of the Football League. I think, you know, us as journalists sometimes look at refereeing situations, and it's the same across a lot of sports. You know, it'd be great if people who played the game then transitioned and went into officiating. Is it discussed, or do they all sit around going, "I hope I can get a job on the Game podcast like you, mate"?
It became... I know a couple of players who did the training.
Really?
Yeah. Because the PFA did start to kind of to push it, particularly on players who played in the lower leagues, because they'd be more open to doing it. No.
No?
I mean...
He wanted to come and work with you two, that's
of course, right. Yeah.
that goal's not achievable for everyone.
No, that's true. No, but no, you say they did the training, but then...
No, I mean they've gone into coaching.
Right.
So it's still I don't know, I still think it'd be a brave individual who's a former player who would take that step. I think it will happen. I think it probably is happening, actually. I think there'll be some people who are on that kind of pathway, but just because you know what you're in for.
Do you think there's still a kind of them and us feeling to referees and players, or do you think that's closing up?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I wrote a piece a few years back about anyone who's not played the game, there's still kind of feeling that they don't know what they're talking about to the same degree, and that absolutely counts for footballers. Yeah. Some managers I played for would just be so scathing towards referees and fourth officials. And
do you think that would then stop, you know, as you get to retirement, you know, you're in your club of ex-pros, you don't want to be kicked out the club by going and being a referee?
No, I think it would help their kind of having a bit of kudos on the pitch, and, you know, certainly people would be less willing to sort of call someone a school teacher in a derogatory fashion, saying that's what your expertise is in. I know managers who would say that all the time, and I think it's the same as in coaching, and I don't think it's fair. I haven't been in this side of the fence now for a little while, but there's if you're a coach who goes into the kind of professional ranks and you've not had a playing career, you've got a barrier to overcome, and that's been knocked down by several high figures, but it's still there. And absolutely, it would be the same in refereeing.
And in other sports, it comes from a basic respect for the official that is there in other sports, but it is not there in football. The way that, you know, this opposition to having referees mic'd up or whatever is in part because they don't want to hear how referees are actually spoken to. They don't want the fans to hear how referees are actually spoken to on a football field. Whereas when you mic up a rugby referee and the first thing you hear is the captain going over and say, "Sir," you know, if he's got anything to say, it starts with the word "sir," "sir this" or "sir that." And you know, that is not going to happen in football. And they're terrified of people hearing the disrespect that's shown. And if you talk to anybody who played football and rugby, like some of my lads did and stuff, the way they talk to the football referees is completely different to the way they talk to the rugby referees, but it's the same individual doing the talking.
Absolutely,
fascinating. It's just a complete difference between the sports.
Yeah. Well, not for the first time this season, we've already stumbled on a subject that I think we could do an entire podcast show on. So keep your eyes peeled. Maybe we'll have a Game podcast special on refereeing at some point this season. But we've got to move on to talk about the title decider. Second week of the season. Manchester City v Newcastle is going to be the Premier League champions, aren't they? We joke, but do we? Slightly. Everyone's already thinking about it. Martin, what are your views of this game?
It could be. You don't know. Saturday, who knows what it's going to be? Could mean absolutely nothing. Come May, you could be looking back and saying, tell you what, that result on August the 19th, second Saturday in the season, that's when it all flips. I do think that the next few months, if someone is going to topple Manchester City, it's the next few months when they haven't got Kevin De Bruyne, yeah, that is where you've got to make hay. And I know Arsenal did last season, you know, and then got slowly reeled in. But losing Gundogan, losing Mahrez, you know, it might not be the same Manchester City this season. I mean, Cole Palmer looks a bit of a player, but it might not be the same Manchester City this season. So now's the time when you've got to take advantage. And, you know, Eddie Howe, Newcastle, that looks a good team. That really does look a good team. And so they go there on Saturday. If you can get a point out of that game and you're Newcastle, who knows where that leads towards the end of the season, particularly if in the next few months City drop some points that you didn't expect them to because they're their best outfield player down, with all respect to Erling Haaland, in terms of creation and goals and assists and all of that. I do think it's a significant game, and that's not saying, oh, it's only these two that are in it, but I think it's a very significant game.
Do we think the significance is far more based on Newcastle and their rise and that first win against Villa? You know, I've been speaking with Martin Hardy, our North East correspondent, about his preview to this game, and it's all Newcastle. It's all about how, I think it's an amazing stat, they played 18 times at the Etihad, only got a point once back in 2004-05 when Martin quizzed me over the phone, and I was thinking, who the hell scored that goal? Alan Shearer. Alan Shearer, remember when he used to play football? Unbelievable, I couldn't believe it. But do you feel like, Johnny, it's more about them? And City will kind of just sit there and go, come on, you're going to come at the king? You've got to come.
I mean, and City are, they can manage a season. And, to, you know, as Martin said, we know they finish really well. They'll grow. If they do lose, they've got time to try and make it up. On the flip side, Newcastle, if they're going to be this season's Arsenal, now is the time. And before the Champions League campaign starts as well. And it's about momentum. They're in such a good moment. They have all the tools to trouble Man City. You know, they are so dynamic, pressed so ferociously. The Harvey Barnes has added to a retinue of really pacey players that can get behind defences. Tonali, exceptional energy, great all-rounder. Exactly the type. There's a sort of feel of those really good counter-pressing teams about them, like a Liverpool of a few years ago. And that's the type of team that does trouble City from time to time if they can get it right. Is Eddie Howe thinking about the title? I wouldn't have thought so. Just he's a pragmatic manager. But it's about progress for them. And my goodness me, going and beating City at the Etihad, what he should be saying to his players, this is the moment we can do this.
Let's lay down a marker. Gregor, you've had your say on Newcastle on Monday's show. When it comes to City, obviously won another trophy with the Super Cup win on penalties. You know, how do you look at their squad? Martin referenced Kevin De Bruyne out for 4 months. Does it feel like they're a little bit light? Is it strange to say that about Manchester City? Phil Foden has been pretty inconsistent, I would say. Struggled with injuries, of course. Cole Palmer, yes, he's exciting, but you wouldn't be expecting City to be going, oh, this kid coming through is going to save us for the next 4 months, do you think?
They look weaker, absolutely, for the two players that Martin referenced who've left, and now for De Bruyne being missing, they definitely look weaker. I wouldn't say light. I'm not sure Manchester City could ever look light. But they look weaker, and Newcastle are one of the teams who look stronger. I agree. I think the title's going to be too far for them. But I'm also heartened, if that's the right word, to see some of the areas I've sort of referenced in the preview show that are clear weaknesses in terms of the step down from the quality they have at centre-half and left-back. They're trying to get Lewis Hall from Chelsea, although it's an eye-watering £30 million for a player who's played 12 games, I think, first team games. But they need a left-back. I don't think they can have...
They listened to you on Monday. Maybe. You said it.
Maybe,
you said
it. Maybe.
You said they need a left-back.
I think they need a centre-half. But apart from that, we spoke about it the other day, the competition now is pretty fierce for starting places in that team.
I think someone was saying to me, oh, the thing is, they'll get distracted by the Champions League, when they're in the Champions League, and you say, well, you've got to remember how long it is since they won the title. No one in that city is going to be telling anyone in a black and white shirt, oh, don't worry about the league, all we're interested in is the Champions League. Yeah. You know, it's nearly a century, isn't it, since they last won the league. You know, that city wants to win the league. And, you know, the Champions League will be great. And I was there when they drew 3-3, I think it was, with Barcelona. Mm. And that was an atmosphere to behold. It really was. But they're not going to get stars in their eyes about the Champions League and let the league go. And Eddie's the sort of manager that will make sure that doesn't happen as well.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about this test for Newcastle. It's a test for you guys now. Bill Edgar, each week, is doing his Premier League quiz. Gregor's worried. He's like,
I'm very worried.
Gregor's like, you didn't prep me for this. What's going on? He likes, it's only one question. Bill Edgar's fiendishly difficult quiz, but I think this one is gettable. So now, Newcastle lost only once in the first 6 months of last season. Which team inflicted that defeat and were also responsible for Newcastle's second loss in mid-February?
Wow.
Last season.
This is a good podcast. Total.
Come on.
30 seconds.
I was going
just
for
what you want in a podcast.
I was going for an immediate answer. Go on, someone shout a team.
For a minute.
Shout a team.
Sam at Brentford?
Nope. Go on, Gregor. 3, 2, 1.
Wolves?
No. Martin?
Honestly, I'm not.
I told you it was difficult. The answer is Liverpool.
Liverpool.
Right.
Liverpool.
Okay.
One of the only teams to beat. Newcastle.
Yeah, we could. Can we edit that one out? At the
no. We need
can that stunned
that
mullet
gap.
Silence go
give
in the
big
editing
gap
stage?
Of silence. Now, hopefully,
is everyone start tapping their headphones? Going, is it a bloody the Bluetooth gone again? I tell
honestly,
you what,
it just goes to show what happens when you don't prep a bunch of journalists.
Exactly. Yeah.
Give them a quick.
Yeah, tell
quiz
one
question.
Of us Liverpool, and then the other two. 2 seconds of silence, and then someone jumps in and goes Liverpool, and that's it. And when we can.
I'll keep that in mind for next. Week, Martin. But thankfully,
do.
I have prepped you for this final bit
right,
of the show,
yeah,
where we're
yeah.
going to get
I've
to know you a little
what
bit more, as it's your first show. You're going to be with us every Thursday of the season. But Johnny, these questions are coming for you, and Gregor, for you, also in a slightly different tone. Mm. Martin, we want to know the scariest managerial encounter that you've had in your long career.
I don't find too many of them scary, I must
admit.
I don't find too many of them scary. I had some confrontations, which people... probably know about. One of them ended up on breakfast television when everyone thought me and Alex Ferguson had come to blows. That was on the same trip, funnily enough, in Brazil. Mm. So the first time Alex ever went for me in a press conference, that was because she didn't know it was coming. I didn't really... I worked in Manchester when he just started in like 86.
Right.
So I didn't know him that well, and I didn't know this thing of him exploding at you at a press conference. And... So that came as a surprise. That was, I want to say, in 97. It was over a piece I wrote about Roy Keane when he got injured against Haaland that time. And I wrote a piece in the Express that said, is this guy going to grow up? Because, making the point that Keane, you know, was in a different class to Haaland. What has he got involved in this vendetta on the pitch for and ended up injuring himself? What I didn't know was that he was out for the season. Mm. Alex did. Alex was very upset about this and went for me. And he was a Daily Express reader as well, which was, you know, there weren't too many of them left by that stage, but he was one of them.
He did.
Yeah. And so he went for me, and that was quite intimidating. But then you learn to sort of
dodge the kips of tea that come flying.
He saw me at racing once with all my family. My dad was there, my brother, and all of our kids were there and stuff like that. And after that, we had a lovely relationship or whatever, because he realised I wasn't that different. And Joe Kinnear and I, again, Joe wasn't scary. He was just, you know, that time when he had a go at everybody at Newcastle, and there was some spectacular language and it got quoted on the back pages of the paper. If you haven't been called that word by Joe Kinnear at some stage in your career, you really haven't been doing your job properly. I mean, it started in the... My one with Joe started in the car park at Crystal Palace, at Selhurst Park, when Wimbledon were ground sharing there. It started in the car park. It then went up 3 flights of stairs.
This is him chasing you, is this?
No, this is him...
Start
having a go at me
yeah, right.
and me going back at him Because by then, you'd learn that you just answer
don't
back.
It,
you answer back. That's what you do. So he was having a go at me, Joe. I was having a go back at him. We went up, we left the car park. We went up these sort of staircases, about three flights of staircase, and burst through the doors of the press conference, still shouting at each other at the top of our voices. And the last thing he said to me, I'm not answering any of your effing questions or whatever. So I stood there and I let two or three questions go, then asked a question. And Joe's a good guy, and he just answered it. And that was it. And I really liked Joe.
Ever the showman. Johnny, yeah. Well, Alex, can't be you. He must surely had a favouritism for you, being a Scot.
Fergie, we had a good relationship. But we also had our moments where he shouted at me and I quivered quite a lot.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the scariest, is it?
Well, yeah, look, Fergie is the scariest, I suppose. But the original manager that scared me, I think, was Walter Smith. Because before I came down to England, that was my beginning in Glasgow. So we're talking like mid to late 90s. And Martin will remember this time in journalism where there weren't really press officers. So if you wanted an interview, you spoke to the manager, didn't you? If you wanted anything, you spoke to the manager.
Absolutely.
So Walter was this gatekeeper as well as being the King of Scotland, and because he was on his way to nine in a row. So if you wanted an interview with the Rangers player, you phoned Walter on his mobile. And you said, "I'd like to speak to Eric Bo Anderson." "Why do I do that, son?" And you'd say, "Well, don't speak about his dog." "All right, okay." You know, there was a story about Eric's dog. So, he was Walter was this great combination of your kind of like favourite teacher and the teacher you were also the scaredest of. And I remember doing an interview outside the change. I was speaking to a player outside the changing rooms at Rangers, and Archie Knox, who's his assistant, walked past. And Archie, you know, basically a bit of dressing room banter, expletive-laden banter to this player, and the pair of them were sort of a bit answered back. Now, I was in that sort of phase as a young journalist where maybe you've read, I don't know, too much kind of student-y stuff, and I thought, yeah, I'm going to get all this industrial language into my piece. So, you know, the whole intro was about Archie saying F and this and this and that and that. And then I went to Rangers on the Friday, and Walter had the best poker face you've ever seen. So when I answered the question, she looked at me and went, "Afterwards, son." You just go, "Oh my word, what's happened now?" So I went to see Walter after the press conference, and he said, "Do you understand? Archie's wife read your piece. She's embarrassed. She's got to go out and see her friends. And you've got Archie swearing in the paper." And I'm thinking, if she doesn't know that Archie swears, come on, she's clearly not.
Yeah.
But anyway, so he gave me the, "You've got to go and speak to Archie and apologise. You've got to go and say sorry for this." So yes, Walter. So he marched me down the corridor and knocked on the dressing room door, and there was Archie, who came out in his shorts. And Walter goes, "Go on, son, go and apologise." And it was the most excruciating conversation where I had to go, "I'm really sorry, Archie, for saying that you swore." And he was really sort of shamefaced. He's like, "Ugh." And then I could just see Walter in the background just ending himself. Absolutely. Because he had a great sense of humour as well. Walking away sniggling.
Yeah, I'm sure you learnt a lot from that. Now, Gregor, I'm going to let you be either manager that you saw tear strips off a journalist when you were a player, or manager that scared you as a player.
Well, I played for Joe Kinnear, so it made me think about it. I was at Forest, just remembering the time at Newcastle when he called Nzogbia insomnia.
Yeah,
remember? Insomnia. And you know what? I think he wanted to leave and stuff. Well, I knew that was not intentional because he used to call me George. And he'd never get anyone's name right. He's awful. But the scariest one would probably be Chris Wilder, because he had enough menace to make you think it might even tip over towards violence.
Right.
Like, there was one game where we were supposed to have our Christmas do, and we got beat by, I think it was Plymouth Argyle, and everyone's seen a tactics board being punched off, but he managed to connect and volley it like on the way down before it hit the floor. So it's coming waving through the floor, this tactics board, towards us sitting there. And instead of letting us do our Christmas do, he got us in at 8 o'clock the next morning, just to run laps, like on a Sunday, the day after a game. So he was, I only played for him for a year, but there's a few stories you could tell about Chris Wilder. He had that real menace about him.
There's one I've just thought of, it doesn't concern me, but when I was at another newspaper many years ago, John Lyle, Junior John Hall, was the West Ham manager, and one of our guys wrote that he was going to be sacked the following day. And he wasn't. And at the next time there was a West Ham press conference, he called the newspaper's representative to one side, and he said, this guy that had written this story, he said, you know him, your colleague? Well, yeah, of course, he's a colleague. And he said, got a family? you've got to let this one play out. Right? Has he got a family? So I said, oh yeah, he's married. He said, has he got any kids? He said, well, his wife's expecting a baby. He said, tell him to remember what he did to me. He said, on the day his kids born. Right, now. Jesus. Now, hold on. Before the whole family close the Times podcast down. What he means is that when you write a story that says a man is about to be sacked, his family reads that, and it has an effect on the family. This is what he means. Mm. What it came across like was Bob Hoskins in The Long Good Friday. That's what it came across like, and you know, like it was like that. And if you can remember John Lyle's voice, it would have been that sort of slightly East End voice, you know, like that slight whisper, a little bit, you know, softly spoken. Yeah, and it remains one of the darkest things I've ever heard. But he doesn't mean it like that. He means the toll that a story like that has on the manager's family.
Great, great tales. And as you can see, listeners, it's a tough job being a sports journalist, so make sure you keep buying the Times. If you want to read more of our journalism and keep funding our bodyguards that we need to go to all of these press conferences, go to thetimes.co.uk/thegame. You'll get £1 subscription for 3 months. Martin, Johnny, Gregor, thank you for joining me. Martin, we'll see you next Thursday. Johnny, I hope you see you very, very soon. And Gregor, we'll see you on Monday. Thanks for listening. We'll see you then.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.